Hi, and welcome to A Response of the Day for the second day of Sivan. Today's response is going to be from Shut Avnei Nezer, the Yoredeya section, response number 126. Let's thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hochhauser, for putting these shiurim online and making them available to you so you can listen to them and enjoy them. Let me also take the curtain back on our podcast. I know you listen every single day, anxiously, excitedly, enthusiastically, but you may not realize that these aren't always taped in order, and in fact, the way it went was the first year I was doing these, and this is, I'm in them halfway through the second year, almost done. But the first year that I did these, we did five a day, and only five a day available to you. And I know that meant that Fridays and Shabbatot, well, maybe not Shabbatot, won't say Shabbatot, you were so sad you didn't have a podcast available to you. But now we're in the process, I'm in the process of finishing up the entire series so that there's one available for you every day of the year. And today, as it happens, is the last one that I am taping to complete out a year, because I started the first year just after Shavuot. It seemed like a good time with the giving of the Torah to start a new Torah project. And then I went all the way around to the next Shavuot, skipping only Fridays and Shabbatot. And so now I've been rounding out. So this is actually, in some sense, the last recording, with the exception of Adar Sheni, which won't happen this year of Tuf Shin Ayin Chet. It will only happen in Tuf Shin Ayin Tet, so it's like almost a full year, and then we'll have the other Shenis online, the second Adar response online as well. So this is in some sense the completion moment for the project. I have a few more to do in terms of Adar Sheni, so let's really thank. Let's pause to really thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hochhauser, for their assistance in putting a whole year of response a day. Tell your friends that any day you want a half-hour shiur in an order where you get a whole unit when you're done. Here it is. So let's see what the Avnei Nezer has to say. This response from the Avnei Nezer actually deals with a lot of important issues that come up in lots and lots of circumstances where I think many Jews don't understand the halachot at all. And they don't realize there are halachot about this question. The question is, to what extent are Jews permitted or prohibited to be part of, to be implicated in the sinful actions of other non-Jews? And the case at hand was, there was a mumar, meaning a Jew who sadly did not care as much about halacha as he should have, who would eat the Bisar Achorayim Davka. He wanted, you know, rump roast. He wanted hind quarters of animals. And the problem is, for Jews, we don't eat those because of Gid HaNasheh issues. We don't eat those because we think, or we worry, we don't know the proper way to get out the Gid HaNasheh, the nerve, the sinew that Yaakov Avinu, that was hurt in Yaakov Avinu, and therefore the Torah created a prohibition to eat Gid HaNasheh. And then Chazal added to that, I'm pretty sure it's Chazal who added the prohibition of the fats around the Gid HaNasheh. So we have all these worries about that part of the animal. We tend not to eat them, but he insisted on eating them. So he would send his woman, as it were, he would send his maid servant to the marketplace, and she would buy it. Then she would buy from kosher animals or from non-kosher animals. By non-kosher animals, we don't mean like horse. We mean non-kosher animals, animals that did not have a proper shkita. She would go to the kosher butcher. If the kosher butcher didn't have, or it was too much, or this or this, then she would go to the non-kosher butcher. For a long time, the Jews in the town did not realize that he was Jewish. The Jewish butcher, the Jewish meat sellers. So they didn't realize he was Jewish, and they would therefore sell to him. So I'm sorry, to what extent do they have to stop him or work to stop him from violating this prohibition? So now that they know. So the person asking the question. Now, the Avnei Nezer points out that the Ramah quotes a Yesh Machmirim about this issue, but the Shach says, Mumar ain't Beitin B'tzuvin Haf Risho, and others had doubted that question. So the question is, when we have a rule that we have to care about the observance of our fellow Jews, and therefore we're not allowed to help them sin for sure, and may even have an obligation, we generally assume that Beit Din has an obligation, the court has an obligation, as representatives of the community, to stop other Jews from sinning. That would mean that we each also have some obligation to do so. The Shach said, though, that if somebody has left observance, and this comes up often, too often, sadly often, in our Jewish context, if somebody has left observance, do we continue to have an obligation to stop that person from sinning? The Shach thought we don't anymore, because he thought that the person's choice to leave observance Judaism put them outside the community enough that they're no longer our obligation. In that sense, and later authorities weren't sure. And the Nogam Revova strongly felt that wasn't true. He thought it was astounding to say, because he points out that the pasuk about a kohen, there's a verse about the kohen that says, v'kidashto, that if a that we are supposed to help or insist on a Kohen acting with certain levels of Kedusha, of sanctity. When the Gemara in Yevamot Pechet Amud Bet says that if a Kohen violates that, so for example, let's say a Kohen insists on marrying a divorcee when he's not allowed to, so we as a community work to stop that Kohen and to force that Kohen to divorce her. So the Dogma Revov is saying that shows you that even though he's chosen to violate a prohibition in the Torah, we choose to stop. Now, of course, the Shach could have responded, that's a case where the Kohen is still part of the community at large. He just chosen to do this one action, whereas we're talking about a Mumar who's completely left. But we'll continue and see. When the Mitzvah Aseh points out the Avni Nezer, when it's come to an obligation, the rule in Halacha is, we don't do this anymore because our Batei Din, our courts, no longer have coercive power. But the reminder of a time when courts had coercive power tells us a bunch of things. First of all, it ideally should remind us that Halacha did not think of individual rights as being the be-all and end-all that they often are thought of in modern Western democracies, and that's somewhat of a loss. There's ways that can be done to an exaggerated extent and can be done to a problematic extent, and we see that, unfortunately, as well. But many Jews have forgotten that observance was supposed to be a mix between, as is life, a mix between the individual and the communal, the individual and the societal, and both were supposed to have a say in everybody's lives. Certainly, people were supposed to have more of a say in their individual lives than the community was, and they were supposed to have room to make their own choices without the community always getting involved. But when it came to flagrant violation of the commandments or flagrant refusal to fulfill commandments, so there the community was supposed to get involved. So the example at hand is Mitzvah Aseh, Makin Oto Achetetzin Oshav. The Gemara Ketubot tells us that the court would coerce somebody even by flogging, even to the point of death. So let's say the guy said, I'm not shaking a lulav this year. So we would generally require and force Jews to fulfill positive commandments in the Torah, and also we would stop them from violating prohibitions. So that was all taken as evidence that when it came to a mumar, we went to somebody who had abandoned observance, we would continue to do so. I think the Shach's argument is that a mumar is different, and the mumar has completely abandoned everything and has left the community in that sense, therefore the community stopped taking responsibility for them. But that's the debate at hand. Now you might argue that let's say that we have the right to coerce, we still continue to coerce. Let's say the Dagal Mirvav is right, but maybe even though the Dagal Mirvav is right, that we would tend to say we do our best to make Jews toe the line and observe the Torah. Maybe that's only when we have the ability to coerce them in some way, but let's say we don't. So for example, this guy who wants to buy hindquarters, it was clearly already in Sukkotchev at the time, or whoever was asking the question, the Avni Nezer in Sukkotchev, whoever was asking the question was living in a place where the Jewish community could not stop him anymore, obviously, because he was doing it. Right? So that was one of the things that happened in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and throughout the 19th and 20th centuries on the non-Jewish calendar, and into the 21st, is that communities, by and large, are unable to coerce people. So you might argue, says the Avni Nezer, you might argue that if we can't coerce people in general, that we don't have to withhold the item either. Meaning, you tell the butchers, no, you can't sell to him because he's not keeping the Torah right. You can't be part of that. They might say, well, if we could force the guy to eat kosher, I'd understand your claim. But maybe once he's not going to eat kosher anyway, we don't have to withhold this item for him. So the Avni Nezer says it's not true, because if you look at the run in Ketubot, this is on the pages of the Rif, Daf Nun Amud Aleph 50a in the pages of the Rif. The Ran is clear that even if we can't force somebody physically, we can still force them financially to the extent that we have the ability to. And then and there's a note saying, well, but maybe the Ran isn't agreed upon by everybody, the Ramban. So that might be more of a complicated topic that we can leave for another time. So he points us now to another source that will say a similar idea and that will give us more of a grounding for the idea that we're looking for. Tosos in the beginning of Shavas on the page 3a says, Moshit chefetz chavero, if you're going to extend an item to another Jew, even if afim biladav hayayacholika chachefetz, even if the Jew could have secured that item without you, so it's a non-kosher item, or it's an item that's not their right to have, or in Shabbos terms, let's say it's an item that they're going to carry on Shabbos. So they need you to reach it out to them so that they can start doing the carrying. Even if they could have gotten this item without you, mikom makom asur, it's still prohibited to do. Share afilu lahafrisho hu mikuyav, because there's an obligation not only not to partake of the sin, So in some sense, you're not partaking of the sin because the person could have done the sin without you. But Tosa says, there is an obligation to separate the person from the sin. Therefore, they prove that the fact that the Jew could get it without you doesn't mean you're allowed to give it to them. So, and this is, but to some extent, it's not understood because the Tosa is talking about a situation where if you take away the item, then he won't, the other guy won't be able to be motzi, to violate Shabbat by carrying that item, taking that item to the public thoroughfare. It's true that it's not leaf thing either anymore. It's not. So there is a prohibition on the Torah that people forget of called that we're not allowed to put a stumbling block before the blind, and that is clearly understood to include at a Doraita level, at a biblical level, that if a Jew could not sin without our participation or without our making this available item available to him or helping in some way, the Jew could not sin. That's lif ne'iva. That's a problem of putting a stumbling block before the blind. But I couldn't stop him anyway. So maybe this item he couldn't carry, but there's another very similar item he could carry. Right? So he could, because he could get it from somewhere else. So why do I have to stop him? Right? So if the Tavdin says, I don't understand, why do I have to stop him at all? He can get it from somewhere else. So now, the Avdin is, what's interesting, the Avdin is, you have to know that by the time I was growing up, you know, in yeshivas, people had found these sources or knew these sources. The Avdin is sort of like looking for them. He's going to find them. But it's like a new idea to him. As he says, if you look in the Ritva, on the Vodazar, the Ritva points out that there's something called Heter She'eno Betray Ibrei Din Nahara Im Tava Beferish Isur. And he Dibishim Lifte Iver Likalaka. Let's say, so the classic example of the Gemara is two sides of a river. Let's say there's a Nazir, somebody who has sworn, taken an oath not to drink any wine, who decides he wants a cup of wine. But he's on a side of the river, he can't get across the river, and he can't reach the wine, and I'm on the other side of the river, and I could reach the wine out to him. That's Lif Ne'ivir. But the Gemara says it's only when he's on the other side of the river he can't get it himself. When he can get it himself, that's not Lif Ne'ivir anymore, because I'm now not the one putting the stumbling block before him. The stumbling block is already there before him. So, but the Ritva says, but if he asks me for something that's prohibited, so it's true, it's not Lif Ne'ivir, but there is another prohibition called Misayeya. So this prohibition of Misayeya is very lesser known among Jews today, because I know people will say, there's no problem with X and Y and Z. Misayeya is, if we help somebody, if we in any material way aid somebody in violating an isur, let's be clear, because this is an important piece of it, even if that person could do the prohibition on their own without us, right? That's exactly the example. We're on the same side of the river. He can reach the wine on his own, so it's not lif ne'iver. I am not materially, I mean, I am not the reason why this Jew can violate his prohibition. But I'm helping him do so by giving him the wine. That's a problem of misayeh. It's a rabbinic prohibition of helping. Vilo ot, says the Avnei Nezer, el shechayavim limkot. Not only are we not allowed to help, I think that's also the quote from the Ritva, not only are we not allowed to help, we have to try to protest, we have to try to stop people from sinning, to call Yisrael or Yivim Zebazek, because we say, this is something that people like to quote in the positive, we all feel a responsibility towards each other, but halachically, that responsibility we all feel towards each other extends to the fact that we have to try to stop people from sinning. And if we see them sinning, we have to say something, and we have to say something. So that's an important piece of it. People, I think, today know this principle called Mutav Shiyu Shogin Vayu Mizidin, and it's true as well, which is that in cases where we absolutely know they're going to sin, no matter what we say, and they don't now realize the full extent of their sin, that maybe we're not supposed to tell them because we are sort of helping them by avoiding telling them the full extent of their sin. And there's truth to that as well. But you have to remember, means that we have a responsibility to other Jews, and to the extent that we can, we're supposed to not only not help, we're supposed to protest, but certainly not help. So the Avnei Nezer rehearses all this, reviews all this for us, and this is, but he thinks, after thinking about it, he says, I think the shach is right. In other words, the fact that the man's a mumar has completely left Judaism, that changes the status, changes the situation. This has important ramifications for our times as well. When we confront Jews who sadly have left observance, to what extent are we supposed to, or are we supposed to, or required to, avoid helping them sin? There's a responsible Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, which is not our topic today, but became very, very famous, I think, because Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was asked about, can you give food to a fellow Jew who you know won't make a bracha on the food? So is that not in some sense helping that Jew? Right, it's not lifting Iver because the food Jew can easily get food without you. But are you not in some sense aiding and abetting this Jew in failing to make brachot, failing to make blessings on items in which he's obligated to do so. So the idea that the Jews are going to do it no matter what becomes an important factor in it. And so this is what the Shach is going to say as well. And it's interesting to note that the Dogon Rivava, who's living, you know, 100 to 150 years, living in this late 1700s, so lack of Xerxes starting, has not yet accepted that idea that this category of Jews who have just, I mean, they know the category of Jews who have just left, but that they would change their relationship to the whole Jewish community such that Jews could ignore their violations and just deal with them as if they were almost non-Jews completely. So that was a hard, that was apparently a hard concept for the Dogon Rivava to swallow. Not that he couldn't understand it, but he wasn't able or ready yet to accept it. So the other thing, I think the Shach is right, that once somebody is a mumar, once somebody has abandoned observance completely, so then we no longer have the same relationship to them. Because he says, "Dehine yisod ha'arevut," the foundation of this principle that Jews are obligated towards each other is in Shavuot Lamitenam and Aleph. The verse says, "V'kashelu ish be'achiv ish be'avon achiv." The pasuk talks about kashelu ish be'achiv. People, one Jew will stumble in another Jew, sort of the original concept of the times of war, but the Gemara in Shavuot says that with other people's sins will cause us problems. We will stumble because of other people's sins. And that teaches that the Jews are all responsible for each other. It's like an army at war. In the same way that an army at war, if one person starts losing and starts fleeing, that can affect the whole army. So here too, the sins of one Jew can affect the whole people and can be a stumbling block for the entire people. But the Gemara there limited to where the Jews have the ability to be mocha in each other. They have some effective ability to remonstrate with each other. If they have the ability to effectively remonstrate with each other, so that's when they're liable for, when they're obligated to, and each other's sins affect them. But in a situation where they don't have the ability to do anything, so the Gemara says, then there's no, what are you going to do? Right? How, well, it doesn't really make sense. Kodesh Baruch Hu would punish me for your sins when I have absolutely no ability to affect your choices about making sins. So the Avdei Nezer thinks that means that we no longer have that same level of arivut, of responsibility, of mutual responsibility for the mumar, because they've put themselves outside the community of people who'd like this. So that's a concept of community that I think is A, undebated within halacha, and B, unrealized by even Orthodox Jews. So that's always, to me, a very sad situation. You have a clear fact of halacha, and the fact that many, many Jews, halachic Jews, don't remember that that's a clear fact of halacha. That there is this thing called the community. That community is actually more expansive than Jews sometimes admit to themselves, and yet, and includes, therefore, the importance of and the ability of Jews to interfere in each other's lives when those other Jews are doing things that are wrong. And part of the reason why they're allowed to interfere and expect to interfere is that this sense of responsibility for each other extends to helping each other in times of trouble, but it also means that we're all impacted by each other. And if other Jews' sins are impacting me, then I should have the right to step in because they're impacting me. So there's a whole level of interconnection that many Jews today don't realize, and the Avdei Nezer is saying, and that, sadly, that interconnection goes away once we're no longer able to remonstrate with those other Jews and stop them from doing various things. Happens to be we have another halakhic conclusion. We're allowed to lend mumarim beribi. We lend interest to people who have abandoned the religion, have left Judaism. So that would be an example where we're treating them like a complete non-Jew, and that would suggest that we no longer feel a sense of that communal responsibility for each other when it comes to mumar. The source for that is a Bala Trumot who's quotes a Ramban, that a mumar is no longer called achicha, a person who has left the religion is no longer called your brother in the fullest sense. And arivut, after all, comes from verse says, v'kashlu ish be'achiv, that they're going to stumble one in their brother. So if they're not our brother anymore, and we know that because we're allowed to lend them an interest because we think that they're not considered in achicha, so then they would seem that be considered an arivut as well. So it's an important principle. It's a daunting principle. Because and we don't have to take that to the fullest extent as we don't today. Meaning, if we know today, Jews who sadly no longer observe halacha, we'll often think of them as tinokot shenishbu. We'll think of them as Jews who have, you know, been raised in an environment where they couldn't have known any better, and therefore we think of them as not fully liable for everything that they do wrong, and that can easily be true. And then the question becomes, so if you met a Jew who was completely unaffiliated, right? You know, and let's say had a non-Jewish father and doesn't realize anything about the Jewish obligations, would you insist on refraining from lending them an interest because you think, no, they're included in Achicha? So the answer is we don't include them in Achicha. We just don't think it's true. We hope that one day they'll come back to being part of Achicha, but they currently aren't. And then that would mean then, let's say they wanted to buy hindquarters from us, or let's say, right, we feel that our intercommunal obligations prohibit us from doing so, and that you got to remember, if we refuse to sell them stuff, they're going to be annoyed about it. So there's two sides to that question. Should we feel the responsibility to try to keep them from sinning? It's almost a self-defeating gesture, right? So, but that means then that the excuse, the Avnei Nezer, or the way, the legal mechanism by which the Avnei Nezer is finding room to say, no, we can sell them what they choose to buy from us, and easily today, you can imagine somebody arguing, and that will help us foster better relations and maybe one day bring them back, which easily could be true. But the way to do so is by saying that they aren't currently qualified as achicha, as our brethren in the fullest sense, and therefore we don't have that fullest sense of responsibility to them. And that works according to the poskim, according to the authorities who say you can lend money to a mumar at interest. But there are those authorities who say you cannot. We are not allowed to lend to a mumar at interest. But nonetheless, says the Avnei Nezer, he thinks even then there's room to say we could sell this Jew the hindquarters, according to Maharal and Nitivot Olam. When the Maharal says that the Arivut, the communal interconnection and sense of responsibility for each other, happened in the Torah only after the Jews crossed the Jordan. That's a Gemara in Sota on Laman Zayin and Rebet, but Maharal explained it as now. This is going to be a philosophical idea. And the Avnei Nezer, Maharal is a well-accepted philosophical authority in Judaism. It's seen as a very traditional Jewish thinker, so it's not completely surprising that one can rely on a Maharal. It's not like I question that ability, but the Avnei Nezer is about to apply a what we would have called a philosophical, a hashkafic idea, which we often try, sometimes we often treat as looser and less halachically binding than other kinds of ideas. He's about to apply that to halachic realities. He's going to say, the Maharal says, why is it that the full sense of Jewish communal interresponsibility and interconnection and confraternity, I don't know if that's the right word there, but and sense for each other and obligations towards each other of protection and of assistance, mutual protection and mutual refraining from sin and helping others refrain from sin, that only happened once they crossed into the land of Israel. Maharal said that's because the land of Israel is a special place and it makes all the Jews on it like they're one unit, one person. Powerful idea, important idea, and again, an idea that flies in the face of much of Western individualism, meaning lots of ideas out there are true in some sense, and yet need the counterbalance of the other part of the idea. If the Rambam is right, and I assume he is, because he is often, and because he got it from Aristotle, and Aristotle there is right, and the Torah thinks he's right. So if both Aristotle and the Torah think something is right, then it's usually right, that we look for the middle road in life. The middle road all means there's always that other side, and that if we stray too far to one side, we're losing sight of the other side. So Western individualism is not that it's wrong, it's that it's just unfortunately taking this idea too far. So the Maharal is saying that when it comes to the Jews of Israel, Jews of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, what creates that responsibility for each other, that sense of arevut, Yisrael arevim zebazeh, arevim, by the way, it doesn't only mean responsible, it means really mixed up together, or bavim to some extent, with each other, such that another Jew's sins are my problem, which gives me the right to, as a community anyway, to prevent another Jew from sinning forcefully, and to require another Jew to perform mitzvot forcefully. All of that comes from the fact that Maharal says that in the land of Israel, the Jewish people are in some important sense one person. In the same sense, you know, that parts of our body all make up one whole, the Jewish people are all really one whole in some important sense. They're all individuals as well, but they're all also part of the body. And therefore, there are ways in which one part of the body is allowed to require another part of the body to do certain things, right? So if that's true, then you might have thought that the point of the Maharal was that outside of Israel doesn't count. But once they went into Israel together, then says the Avnei Nezer, well, even if they come out, then the arevut, the interconnection stays, but that's because mikomam shel Yisrael be'eret Yisrael, our place of Jews is in the land of Israel. And there's an obligation of Israel. And that's important to me to note because this is 1896. I don't know if I mentioned that before. The second of Sivan of Tafresh Nun Vav of 1896. And he's writing and taking for granted that there's an obligation to live in Eretz Israel. Later, when it became an actual, more feasible possibility, you find a lot of Acharonim talk about is it an actual obligation? Is it a full obligation? The answer is clear that it's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Israel. So therefore, he says, it's as if we're all still in Israel, even though we're not in fact in Israel. Now, it's true that a mumar, who's left observance, is still considered a part of the Jewish people, right? But then the Anizir says, mikol makom goyhu gam kein. Right? But he's also treated halachically as a non-Jew in some senses. He's certainly a Jew in the sense that we want to bring him back. He's certainly a Jew in the sense that we think of him as a Jew in lots and lots of ways, but he's also a non-Jew. Forget the ribbis question, whether we can lend to him at interest. But another example is, Oseh Yayin Nesech. The halacha is that if a Jew like that touches wine unsupervised, we have to treat it like we can't drink it. And Kana'im Pogim B'mumeret Kimo B'goya. This I had not known, that in Eben HaEzer, when it's talking about the question of, so these are all negative examples. We're treating a non-Jew, mumar, it's a non-Jew in ways that are sort of negative to that mumar, the person who's been a Jew. And this example was, there's a law in the Torah, which we don't keep today for lots and lots of important reasons, including that it violates the laws of the land. But theoretically, the Pinchas situation that you have in the Torah, where Pinchas witnesses a Jew having relations with a non-Jew, halacha l'moshe b'Sinai is, quoted in the Mishnah, is that Kana'im can do that in any time, in any place. That how you'd find a Kana'i, a zealous person, is something to think about before we would enact this halacha. This is not a practical point right now, just relevant to our discussion here for an ancillary reason. Theoretically, a Jew who was righteously offended, to find that is very difficult, by a Jew having relations with a non-Jew, could kill it. Let's assume that for a second, and we're not getting into that, but the Kavanezer says that he holds, and he seems to think that it's like a general assumed thing, that would be true even for a Jewish woman who has abandoned observance, a mumeret. That if a Jew was caught having relations with a mumeret, now, tinogot shenishbu, Jews who grew up non-observant could be a whole different situation, but a Jewish woman who has consciously, willfully, and deliberately abandoned observance, so she would have that same status. That comes up in another context where we want to define abandoned Jews as non-Jews. Let's suppose a woman is widowed without children. So there's supposed to be a halacha called Yibum or Chalitza. Either she's supposed to marry her brother-in-law or have a Chalitza from that brother-in-law. Let's say that brother-in-law, and the only one, has abandoned Judaism and is not available for either one. Because once you've abandoned Judaism, you very often will resist partaking of what seem to you stupid Jewish ceremonies. So there, one of the ways that halacha helped these widows was by saying that the mumar didn't count for these purposes, but that's a way to say the mumar is really Jewish. So the Avner is pointing out that halachically, we treat mumarim, we treat Jews who have abandoned religion as non-Jews in some ways. Another example is the Drisha says that when it comes to, let's say a mumar, a Jew who abandons Judaism has actually joined some other religion, some other idolatrous religion, so that we treat his idolatries as if they had been created by a non-Jew, which has certain halachic ramifications. So if it's true that a mumar, a person who's abandoned the religion, counts in some senses as a non-Jew and in some senses as a Jew. Now, we're talking about a mumar here who has done so willfully and deliberately. The people who are not observant in our times are a more complicated case, because there we can argue that many of them are tinokot shenishbu, they just never knew better, and that changes their status in very important ways. So this part of it you couldn't apply directly to Jews today unless you thought through it very carefully. But a Jew who grew up in a completely observant environment, there was no reason why he or she should have abandoned, and then abandons the religion, they would have all this complicated status. But the Avnezer says, so it's clear that we couldn't let such people live in our land with us because the Torah prohibits having non-Jews, to the extent that we're able to keep them out, having non-Jews live in the land of Israel unless they accept basic fundamental Jewish ideas, and they accept the seven Noahide laws, which include not worshiping any power other than Hashem, because the verse says in the Torah, "Pen yaktiu ot kali," that lest they lead you to sin. That's a complicated question, and unfortunately I've let this go on too long because I find this topic so interesting, but the Avnezer is basically saying that in the same way the Torah prohibits us from letting idolatrous non-Jews live in the land of Israel because they'll lead us astray, they will lead us away from proper observance, then we see that halacha treats a Jew who willfully decides to leave the religion as also possibly creating, is also likely creating that kind of a problem for us because they have statuses of a non-Jew in many, many ways. They can't live in Israel. Once they can't live in Israel, as in their current status, unless they repent one day, God willing, they'll repent and they'll come back. But until they do, the fact that they treat them as a non-Jew to the Ebenezer shows you that we also would be allowed to let them live in Israel. And that brings us back to the Maharal. The Maharal said that the whole foundation of the idea of Arevut, of interconnection, of our mutual responsibility for our fellow Jews, depended vitally on the idea of that we were one day in Israel together, and one day, God willing, again, we'll be in Israel together. But these Jews won't be in Israel, so therefore it would seem like the whole responsibility of Arevut goes away. And if it goes away, then we don't have to care anymore about being part or not part of their violations of the Torah. So you could have argued a flaw in this thinking. He argues, right? Now, I was thinking, maybe you could say, well, all the butchers of non-kosher kosher meat, meaning of kosher animals that are non-kosher, are Jews. So if that's true, then if you made the rule that no Jewish butcher can sell this guy the hind quarters, then he couldn't get it today. So you could say, maybe now you actually have a biblical prohibition of this thing either. Maybe it's a biblical prohibition of that we're going to be helping him sin in a way that he could not do right now. So you could say, well, he could send to another town to get it. We could, but he could only do that for tomorrow. He can't do that for today. And therefore, you might think that today, it's a lifting Iver problem. Now, it's a little bit stretched because once he learns that Jews aren't going to sell to him, that he would regularly get from elsewhere, and then it would no longer be the lifting Iver issue, but he's just saying each particular day to the lifting Iver issue. So he says he doesn't think it is, though, because this Jew, unfortunately, doesn't care that much that it be from kosher animals. For him, pig isn't that much different than cow, than you know, improperly killed cow or properly killed cow. He doesn't really care that much. So if the Jewish butchers all band together and say, we're not selling you beef, he'll buy pig. Now, the Ebenezer refers to it as davar acher, as, you know, another matter, because it was too painful for Jews to say a kazir in halachic writings. So I should really say a davar acher, which I'll say from now on, he'll buy a davar acher. Now, that creates a little bit of a complication because the davar acher is, according to some opinions, a different prohibition, meaning the prohibition of beef, of cow that has been improperly slaughtered is a prohibition probably of nevela, whereas the prohibition of davar acher might be a whole different prohibition. The Torah says you can't eat that. So there's a whole complicated discussion about whether or not it's also nevela. If it's also nevela, so then it would be easy that it's the same prohibition. It's got the same prohibition to it. And then you could say it's not a lifting issue. But if it's a different thing, then you could say maybe the butchers have to not sell them the beef. And yeah, he'll go to somebody else and buy davar acher, but that'll be a different prohibition. But nonetheless, that isn't so okay, because even if that were true, the prohibition, now he says chazir, so I could say it too. Chazir is a more serious prohibition. In a lot of ways in the Torah, we treat chazir as very important prohibition, because if you're going to say it's the same prohibition, it's got two, right? The only question is it's got two. It's got that it's chazir and that it's an nevela. And also, there's a Gemara in Kretel that says the people who insist on violating the Torah in this way, we would bury them among Rishaim Gemuri, among those who are full evildoers. So those are the sources of the permissibility that the Ebenezer gives. And he, at the end, dispenses with two ways of thinking of it as mutar that I don't want to get into right now. They're about whether or not we could just assume we could give them the stuff and then assume that they'll fix it up as the way they're supposed to, meaning let's sell him kosher hindquarters and assume that he'll knows the way to get rid of the gid hanasheh, the prohibited parts of it, the prohibited fats of it. So then there's things that you don't have to worry. You can't assume that. And there's a Chavot Yair who says if you give it to a third party, and here it's the attendant, the maidservant, the woman who was sent to buy this stuff, maybe we can say that's not our problem because she's the one who's going to give it to them. So the Ebenezer says that's only true if we have any doubt whatsoever. But if we're confident and certain that this woman will give it to the guy, then we're not allowed to assume with that. So for the second day of Sivan of Tav Shin Nun Vav and forever of Tav Resh Nun Vav and forever after, we have the Ebenezer talking about issues of when we can and cannot sell prohibited items to Jews who have abandoned observance. And his suggestion, his fundamental avenue of permissibility, is one that takes an idea that is a little bit upsetting to us, that we think of Mumari people who have deliberately abandoned religion as not being Jewish enough anymore to be included in this issue of Arevut, is a chumrah on them. It treats them in a stringent way, in a harsh way, but that leads to a cooler, that leads to an avenue of permissibility that I think many of us take advantage of. And I think it's important to remember both sides of those questions. The way to allowing ourselves to treat Jews and sort of let them go off and do their own thing, part of the way to get there is by assuming that sadly they put themselves so far from us that we can't, we no longer required to care about their actions. This has been a responsible day for the second day of Sivan. My name is Gideon Rothstein. We thank the OU Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz and David Hacha. Hauser for their assistance in making these shirim available to you. Have a great day.